So good evening and afternoon, as the case may be, and throughout the United States. Welcome to the monthly conference call. My voice is stressed a little bit tonight, so that's why we have these lawyers who can talk, so I don't have to. So, tonight we're going to talk about polygraphs, and we false build it as everything you want to know. It won't be everything you want to know, because you'll find out things tonight that you don't want to know. And there will be things that you would like to know that we won't be in a position to answer tonight for a number of reasons. We don't have a polygrapher here. I had thought about the possibility of having one, and then I found out that he wasn't available, and also it would have crowded the docket. So I'm planning to have a polygrapher in a future call, depending on how much interest there is in the issue after tonight. So tonight we're going to focus on the legal aspect of polygraph, primarily as it pertains to those who are under supervised release, probation, or parole, or being compelled to participate in polygraph examinations for treatment purposes. So we have introducing everyone. I'm Larry Neely from RSOL National Board. The lovely voice is Brenda Jones from RSOL National Board. And we have Barry Porter from the law firm of Burgess and Porter in New Mexico. And we have Barbara Gale, semi-retired from Rome, Georgia, who's an attorney. So we're going to be talking about a case out of Georgia, and we're going to be talking about a case out of Colorado, which rests within the Tenth Circuit. So we're going to take some questions, and we're going to have a little bit of fun going through polygraphs. I'll tell you before we get started that I have taken polygraph tests myself. I have taken polygraphs in conjunction with employment, pre-employment, and back in the day, I don't know how old everyone is on the call, but back in the day, a lot of employers used to use polygraphs for pre-employment to determine if they were going to hire someone. And then when they had inventory shortages and they had theft, They used polygraphs. Those have been throttled back because of federal legislation back in the 80s. So polygraphs are not as widely used in the private sector. They are very much used in the government sector for national security jobs and for clearances. Polygraphs are quite common. In the last 10 to 15 years, they've become quite common in sex offender management for treatment purposes. And in New Mexico, my state was a pioneer of the polygraph. We started using them regularly more than a decade ago, probably about 15 years ago. So we were on the cutting edge of developing the team containment model here that spread to the rest of the country. So I have also taken a polygraph in conjunction with supervision. And so we can talk about, people can ask me questions about polygraphs in terms of the actual process of working in a law office, and we actually use them for our clients. I'm sure Mr. Porter has had the occasion to do the same thing, but we use polygraphs in conjunction with our own investigations to figure out what we think about a case and where it may lead us. So tonight you were told about the case out of the 10th Circuit of United States versus Von Behring. And then there's a case from Georgia, which is escaping my Barbara. Do you want to refresh my memory about the title of that case?
There was a case out of the district court in Georgia, Noonan Division of the Northern District Court, which is United States versus Laura Chapman, and it had been portrayed as an 11th Circuit decision, which of course it was not. It's just a trial court decision based on a lady's complaint that if she submitted to the polygraph that she would be incriminating herself for conduct that was outside of her plea agreement. And for that particular case, it was really a good finding. The trial court judge said that she would not be required to answer questions concerning incidents for which she could be charged. and that the treatment team would have to find another way to provide her treatment. As far as how this affects anybody else in the world, unless they come in front of Judge Story, there's not a whole lot of, you know, there's no precedence value because it's just a trial court decision. It is not an appellate court decision, which carries some weight.
So this was a federal district judge in the Northern District of the state of Georgia that,
yes,
had a particular case before him, Judge Story, and the defendant argued that she should not have to answer questions regarding conduct outside of the actual case that was before the court. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. She had pleaded guilty to certain conduct, and there were questions that were asked of her that were not activities that were not contained in that charge or that plea agreement, and for which she felt there might be additional charges. And so she did not want to answer those, and that's how the court got, the case got back in front of the trial court. This is a trial court decision in the federal area. People get confused because they think when they hear that a federal court has made a decision that it's like, oh, you know, that's an appellate court decision and that affects everybody. If a crime, if somebody commits a crime that's a federal crime, they go to a federal trial court. If somebody commits a crime in the state of Georgia, they go before a superior court. And so this is really the equivalent of a superior court decision, only on the federal level. It's not an appellate court decision. This has not climbed up through the processes of appeal to have it be a decision that affects anybody other than just this client.
Well, I can't imagine that the defendant would appeal, but is it conceivable, this is a relatively new decision, is it conceivable or probable or likely that the government will appeal?
Well, you never know what the government's going to do, Larry. But because at the judge's decision at the end, he said an alternative treatment program will need to be found, or this matter needs to be brought back before the court for further consideration. So he has left open his ability to still monitor and direct this, where if he had just made a definite decision this has to be done, then there might be something to appeal. But he's kind of left it open by saying that he's willing to see what they have in mind and come back in front of him, and he'll determine whether or not their new idea is still violative of her constitutional rights.
Well, did the court rule that she didn't have to take a polygraph, or that she didn't have to answer specific questions on the polygraph?
That she is not required to answer questions concerning incidents about which she has not pled guilty.
Okay, so
from the order.
Okay, so it's left open the possibility that she can be polygraphed.
She may be polygraphed. She just may not be asked questions about criminal behavior that has not been already taken care of with a plea or a charge.
Okay, so let's move on for the moment, Barbara, to Mr. Porter, because we've got a Tenth Circuit decision. Now let's try to bring everyone up to speed about what a circuit court is before we get into the Von Barry decision. Barry, what is the difference between a circuit court and a district court, and how many circuits are there in the country?
Well, a district court is basically usually at the state level. Like in New Mexico, we only have one district court, and circuit courts are the various courts that oversee those. And you're asking me how many circuit courts there are.
There are 11 plus the D.C. Circuit. I didn't prepare.
There are 11, right. So what happened in the Chapman case, right, happened at the district court level. So that the district court level in the federal system is basically the trial court level. So that judge in the Laura Chapman case was smart and kind of figured, well, this is involving Ms. Chapman's Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate herself. and basically made a ruling at that trial court level and said, hey, you know, go back to the treatment program and the folks that were supervising her and develop either a treatment program that doesn't require her to answer questions that incriminate herself or come back before me. So what happened in the case in Colorado, which is the Von Behren case, so it's V-O-N-B-E-H.
Let's go a little deeper into the difference between a trial court and a circuit court. What makes this decision in the 10th Circuit more valuable than what we just talked about out of the Georgia case? And how valuable is it? How far does this case potentially extend to before we analyze Von Behren? This is a 10th Circuit case, so how is it different from the case out of Georgia?
Well, the 10th Circuit case, right, like every circuit, has court of appeals, right? So these are trial court decisions that are appealed. So somebody says, hey, on the trial court level, the district court level, the judge made a mistake. We're taking it up, and we're having it appealed to the circuit court level, the circuit court of appeals. And the circuits oversee a number of courts. So like you said, there's 11 circuits in the United States, and usually under each circuit there's a number of states. So their reach and their jurisdiction and what is binding, that they say, kind of reaches into many states. So like in the 10th Circuit, which is the Von Behren decision, the holdings in that case that are by that three-panel Court of Appeals group that made the decision are binding in Colorado, in Kansas, in New Mexico here, in Oklahoma, in Utah, and in Wyoming. In the federal system, you go from district court, which is the trial court level, then the next level is the Court of Appeals, which is based upon the different circuits throughout the country, 11 of those, and then above the Court of Appeals is the United States Supreme Court. So this is pretty significant. Court of Appeals decisions carry a lot of weight, and like I said, they're binding in the jurisdictions that they oversee, the states that are part of that circuit.
Okay, so now let's talk about Von Behren. There was a decision early this year from the 10th Circuit in the case of U.S. Von Behren. What was the issue in that case, and bring us up to speed on that, please.
Sure. So kind of just a factual background of Brian Von Behren. He was convicted of distribution of child pornography, and this was in federal court in Colorado. And because it's in federal court, of course, everybody gets slammed to the crazy degree. He actually got a 121-month sentence, so over 10 years, of incarceration. And in federal court, when somebody finishes their incarceration time, in state court, most of the time we call it either parole or probation. In federal court, it's called supervised release. That's kind of the new federal system of post-incarceration supervision. So he got the 10 years, followed by 3 years of supervised release. So upon finishing his 10 years, he was referred to complete a sex offender treatment program, and part of that program was overseen by the Colorado Sex Offender Management Board, who sets out these standards that all of the programs have to follow. And one of the standards that the Colorado Sex Offender Management Board set was that treatment program must conduct sexual history polygraphs. So he was referred to a program that, under Colorado Management Board rules, has to do these sexual history polygraphs. So when he was put into the program, he was instructed by this agency, and the agency there in Colorado, let's see what it
was. It was RMC.
Yeah, RSA was incorporated.
RSA, okay.
RSA. And so he had to participate in RSA, and one of the things they had him do was a sexual history polygraph. And they asked him, in this particular case, they draw out four specific questions that they wanted to ask him that were incriminating, that dealt with, like Barbara said, this is not questions about, you know, the underlying offense for which you were sentenced and put on probation. This is sexual history that is uncharged conduct. So you haven't been prosecuted yet on it. And so these questions included, I'm going to just read from the opinion. One of the first question was, after the age of 18, did you engage in sexual activity with anyone under the age of 15? Right? And so in New Mexico, that would squarely put you in illegal conduct if you answer that question yes. The second question was, have you had sexual contact with a family member or relative? In a lot of states, that's going to be illegal conduct as well. The third question was, have you ever physically forced or threatened anyone to engage in sexual contact with you? That's a sexual assault offense in all 50 states. And number four was, have you ever had sexual contact with someone who was physically asleep or unconscious, also known as rape? So these four questions were all asking him about conduct that was outside of his child pornography conviction. And what Mr. Von Behren did was said, well, wait a second, you're asking me these questions that are going to incriminate myself. And in fact, when I had to sign up for this sex offender program, you had me sign this document that said, that agreed to any information that I provide to these polygraph people or my treatment facility, I agree to let it be disclosed to my supervising agency or the supervised release people, United States Probation. And so obviously that's going to get me in trouble, so I don't want to answer those questions. I refuse to answer those questions. And what happened was he was represented by the federal public defender there in Colorado. They took it before the court, and initially the court did the right thing, kind of like in the Chapman case, and the judge said, you don't have to answer these questions. But then the judge reconsidered and said, you do have to answer these questions. And when Mr. Von Behren refused, when the district court reversed itself and said, you do have to answer these questions, he basically was about to go to a polygraph examination. They asked for a stay from the trial court. The trial court refused the stay. And then he filed this appeal to the circuit court, the 10th Circuit Court, which oversees the state of Colorado as well as the other states I mentioned. And the Court of Appeals issued a stay saying, hey, you don't have to take this polygraph. And the timing of this is just kind of really dramatic. Mr. Von Behren is actually in the parking lot of the polygraph examiner's office when he gets the word the emergency stay has been granted. And the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals is going to look at your issue. So they did take a look at the issue, and really very thoughtful opinion. And they did a Fifth Amendment analysis. And if everybody can kind of remember back to Constitution days, what the Fifth Amendment requires is that somebody not be compelled to provide incriminating information against themselves, right? So we see, senators and congressmen do it all the time, people up at Capitol Hill. So the analysis for the Fifth Amendment to apply, the Von Behren three-panel circuit court did, was to qualify for Fifth Amendment privilege, the communication has to meet basically three criteria. It has to be testimonial, it has to be incriminating, and it has to be compelled. And so they did the analysis and found that, yes, it's testimonial. Yes, it's incriminating because it could lead to a future prosecution. And yes, it's compelled because Mr. Von Behren's put in the position of, you don't have a choice, because if you don't do this polygraph, if you don't answer these questions, we're going to revoke your supervised release and you're going back to prison. So what they ultimately held was his Fifth Amendment rights were violated, and that condition of him having to take that polygraph and answer those particular questions was struck down. Now, it's important to note, it didn't strike down the obligation to take a polygraph at all, it really specifically struck down the idea of having to answer incriminating questions in a polygraph. That's part of a sex offender treatment program. So good and wide-reaching, and I'm sure it's being violated throughout the country, because I'm sure folks who are dealing with sex offender supervision are being asked questions that incriminate them all the time. So it's a good decision that we, you know, hopefully can, with RSOL's help, kind of reach out to a lot of jurisdictions and get them to change their practices.
So, Mr. Port, does the finding, is it narrow in terms of the type of questions they can ask him? Because everybody wants to know, can I just decline to take a polygraph? Is there any suggestion in Von Behring and the decision that you don't have to take a polygraph that you can read into it or out of it?
No, not at all, right? The obligation to take a polygraph, if that's still, you know, part of the terms and conditions of supervised release or post-incarceration release, if that's part of the terms, that obligation is still valid. It's sort of narrow in that it addresses the nature of the questions that can be asked during a polygraph. And what it says is you can't be asked incriminating questions. You can't be compelled to answer incriminating questions. And so, you know, that opens some doors. What's incriminating? You know, what's compelled? And the Von Behring Court kind of address that. And this, again, this is a Tenth Circuit opinion, so it's binding law only in the jurisdictions that are under the Tenth Circuit. It is persuasive authority in all other federal courts.
So what does persuasive authority mean for the non-lawyers out there?
Well, a person
is in Florida in the 11th Circuit, and they know about this decision, so how would that be used to benefit the person who wants to tell Florida probation that they can take their polygraph and they're not going to respond to these particular type of questions? How do they use this?
Well, they just use it to argue basically that the same law that the 10th Circuit applied in Colorado is what should be applying in the 11th Circuit in Florida. And so the 11th Circuit, you know, all the circuits are very different. They have different personalities. Like the 9th and the 10th are kind of known to be more liberal, and then you have other circuits that are known to be very conservative, I think, including Florida. So they may reject this line of thought, or they may distinguish Von Behring, but it's a good argument. And the thought process that the court went through in Von Behring makes good sense, and it's based in good part on United States Supreme Court precedent, which United States Supreme Court precedent is binding on all jurisdictions throughout the country, federal or state. So if a United States Supreme Court says something, then all other courts below it have to follow it. The Tenth Circuit says something, only the courts below the Tenth Circuit and the states below and the state courts below the Tenth Circuit have to follow it by law. It's just a tool for argument, basically.
Okay, so if there was a very similar case in another circuit, and that circuit said, we've analyzed Von Behring and we reject that approach, then what do we have here when we have two circuits saying two separate things, or we have multiple circuits saying some accepting and some rejecting this notion that an offender has the right to not incriminate themselves under compulsion? So what would happen then if we were have several dissecting different opinions?
Well, yeah, what could happen, because what could happen is that nothing, but what possibly could happen, which would hopefully be a good thing and give us a good outcome, is these Tenth Circuit opinions would eventually be applying for certiorari to the United States Supreme Court. And then the United States Supreme Court says, hey, look at these circuits. They can't agree on this. And this law is the United States Constitution. We're talking about the Fifth Amendment. You know, we're the arbiters of what the Fifth Amendment is. If these circuits can't agree, perhaps this is a case we should accept, an appeal that we should accept and render a decision that will apply throughout the country.
That's exactly what I was looking for. A circuit split would be a recipe for possibly a Supreme Court review.
Yeah.
So do the attorneys have any questions or comments to one another? We're gonna open up questions sooner than we normally do here, but do you guys have any observations to or questions for each other?
No, I think not. I think we can just go ahead. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, we can go ahead with the questions from the listeners.
Don't get questions from the listeners, you know, Barbara and you and I spoke earlier that, you know, we have the question about what's incriminating, and, you know, are we talking about a new crime, or are we talking about making statements that will
violate probation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can address that later.
So, well, these attorneys have graciously given us their time to try to answer questions about this type of issue with polygraphs and supervision. So we're going to ask you to please ask a question about polygraphs and supervision and confine it to that. That's what we're somewhat prepared for tonight, and we'll get to other types of legal questions. We hope to do more and more of these calls, if we can find more and more people who want to help prepare for them and be present. But let's try to focus on the polygraph questions. And we know we get a lot of emails. We get a lot of contact about can they do this or that. So if you'll press *6, you'll come up in a queue that Brenda sees.
And, I do.
And she will know how to get you on to ask your question. And let's try to keep it to a question. There may be some background, but allow the attorneys to fish for the background if they need it to answer the question, because it's tempting to tell the story about how you ended up being on probation and how crooked the jurisdiction is and all that kind of stuff, but it really doesn't help get to the question. So let them ask you a question if they need more information.
I guess to summarize, we want to try to keep it short. Just ask a simple question. Don't tell a whole story, and it should be about polygraphs and about the legal issues that are at hand, especially Fifth Amendment. It sounds like is that a good summary?
That is correct, Brenda.
Okay.
We typically have people who stray into other areas because there's not enough access to attorneys, and if we have an attorney, they want to ask questions about something else, and so please let's try to confine it to Fifth Amendment polygraphs, supervision related to polygraphs.
Okay. We do have several people in the queue, and they're piling up. So we'll just move right on into the next one. Go right ahead.
Oh, hi, it's Cindy from Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Larry. That was really good. Legal for Dummies. Can continue dumbing it up for me. How does this translate to the state level? Okay, this is, you were talking about the federal case out of Colorado. If this same thing is happening here, but it's not a federal case, like, that's what I don't understand. When you talk federal case, you're talking about an inmate who offended at a federal level and is coming out of a federal prison. Is that correct?
We've got the question. We know where you're going. We
what state is Cindy from?
Connecticut.
Connecticut.
Oh, Connecticut.
So, Barry, we'll be happy to explain to you what we're talking about, because we're talking about the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, and that applies in all states. But go ahead, Barry. Explain again.
We talked about, Cindy, that this isn't what we call binding authority on Connecticut, right? Because the Tenth Circuit is not a court that oversees Connecticut. How it applies to state courts, so here I'm in New Mexico, right? New Mexico is in the Tenth Circuit. So I can take this to my state officials and say, hey, look, the federal court that has jurisdiction over this area has interpreted the United States Constitution, specifically the Fifth Amendment, to say when you ask these kinds of questions in a polygraph exam, it implicates, you know, my client's right not to incriminate himself. And so you need to stop asking these questions.
But if we want to start something in the state of Connecticut at the state level, without a circuit decision, That's
right.
We don't have anything going. But
you
if we want to start,
so you do have this is persuasive authority.
So this is perfect. So kind of practically how that would work, Cindy, is you have somebody go in to take their polygraph, right? And ideally, this is, you know, if everything was in perfect in the world, you get the questions ahead of time, so you kind of know the nature of the questions. If you don't, then you have, you know, probationers or supervisees kind of talk about what kind of questions they've been asked. The person goes in for the polygraph. They get asked these incriminating questions. Then this is a key thing in the von Behring decision. They must assert their Fifth Amendment right. Silence will basically equal a waiver of the Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate yourself. So they'll have to assert their Fifth Amendment right, and they'll have to kind of analyze it, and this is why it'd be nice to have the questions ahead of time. They'll have to analyze it on the fly, question by question, and they have to ask basically the two critical issues. Is this question possibly incriminating? Could I possibly be prosecuted for another crime, not a probation violation, could I be prosecuted for another crime by answering this question? And what the von Behring decision says, and this is United States Supreme Court precedent says, is that an incriminating question is a question that could lead or provide a link to a future prosecution. Okay, and so the questions that were asked in the von Behring case, you know, like have you had sex with somebody under the age of 15, certainly that's going to lead to or provide a link to. It's not going to be enough just on the answer to prosecute that person, but it could lead, you know, law enforcement authorities to maybe go get a search warrant or start talking to witnesses around that person and possibly be incriminating. So the question-by-question analysis first, is this question possibly incriminating? And second, there has to be, it has to be compulsory. If I don't answer this question, am I going to be penalized? And it has to be a significant penalty, like loss of liberty. Is my probation going to be revoked?
Barry, let's try to. What she's wanting to hear is how does a person start that process? I know you're getting there, but they have to assert it. They have to say, I can't answer that question. They can't refuse the polygraph. They have said, I can't answer that particular question or that series of questions because of my Fifth Amendment. And whether or not there's a decision in Connecticut, there is a Fifth Amendment in the United States across the land. So they have to assert that. And you don't get they don't mail you the questions in advance. But what they do is before they hook you up, they provide you the questions because the treatment provider has told them what they're looking for, unless it's a sexual history, and then they're just looking at all your sexual history. But if it's a maintenance polygraph, or if there's an issue, or if it's an issue-driven polygraph, they will tell you when they sit down, we're going to question you along these lines, and here are the questions that I've composed. So you get the questions before they hook you up, but you don't get them much in advance of that. Mm-hmm. So at least that's the way they do it around this state.
Asked the question, and then your response is, I respectfully decline to answer that question because it may incriminate me, and I assert my Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate myself. And then they say, well, if you don't answer that question, we're going to revoke you. Then, you know, the probationer or the person on supervised release has to make a decision. Do I want to risk, you know, immediate incarceration or not tell the truth? So if the person answers that question and says, I assert my Fifth Amendment right, and they say, well, we're going to revoke you, then hopefully they don't arrest you right away. You take that immediately to a lawyer or to the public defender office and say, hey, listen, there's this von Behring decision, and I asserted my Fifth Amendment right. I need you to take this into court and have, then so a lawyer takes it into the trial level, whatever the trial level is at that state, and basically moves for you not to have a revocation or some sort of order from the court saying these questions are not proper because they implicate the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. You get the trial court to hopefully order them to stop doing that. The trial court doesn't, then you're setting it up for an appeal in your state system. So go from the trial level probably to the Court of Appeals or, you know, whatever your appellate courts are called, eventually to your state Supreme Court. And then you get a ruling from them.
Thank you,
Cindy.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll move on to the next question. Go ahead.
Yes, my name is William. I'm calling from the New York 2nd District. Typically in New York on parole, when they ask for your sexual history, that pretty much implies like your overall history sexually. They're not pretty much asking for the polygraph for your individual underlying offense. They pretty much ask for the history with, you know, pretty much fits all the criteria of the testimonial, incriminating, and compelling, because it's not limited to that one area. So those that pretty much attempted to be non-compliant by their standards have been violated on parole because they say that parole is a privilege and you have no right to be on parole if you're non-compliant with their model of parole. So what could be done, because, you know, typically you do 3 months, 4 months, you might get reinstated, but it doesn't change the policy. You're going to be asked again within 6 months, similar questions, similar procedures. So what could be done actually to kind of create some kind of ripple in the overall procedure? So, you know, 6 months is postponed, but nothing's changed. You just went into prison for 6 months, you're back, same conditions, same rules, same stipulations. So what could you kind of do to, like, avoid that when they're not really respecting the fact of that being an inherent right under the Constitution? They're trying to say that parole is pretty much a privilege.
So what happens is, you know, somebody violates, they violate somebody on parole because they refuse to answer one of those questions. Is that right?
Right. They're not complying with therapy and parole supervision.
Right. So then the revocation of parole should be appealed.
Right. But when it's done, you reinstate it 6 months later, and then while being on parole, 6 months later or a year, you're confronted with the polygraph again. Nothing has changed. And if you go about it in a similar way, the likelihood of the results changing is very slim. You know, so you are being reinstated, but you're losing 6 to 9 months each time that you suffer the revocation hearing because you're being arrested immediately in the New York district. It's not like you get to leave and contact a lawyer. You know, so what could be done from that level in the New York area to kind of like, you know, exercise this particular right without continually reverting back to the correctional facility for 9 months at a time.
Right. Well, I don't know, Barbara, you want to jump in and answer that?
I knew you were going
to
say that.
It's a tough situation. Well, I would love to have a stab at it because we've got the Utah model, which is exactly on point. And although they're going to reinstate you, is what they did in Utah. Your appeal of the revocation can go forward even while you're reinstated.
Okay.
The legal issue that you're raising is not mooted out because it's one of those that is an exception to what we call the mootness doctrine. There are exceptions, and this is an issue that will overcome the exception because it has a propensity and possibility and likelihood of repeating itself. So when the state moves to dismiss your appeal of the previous revocation because it's moot, because you're out, you object because you say that this is an exception to mootness doctrine. And the two lawyers can jump in and say if I'm wrong.
Right.
Because
it's something that's going to just keep happening and keep being repeated.
Right.
So it's something that the court, under an exception to the mootness doctrine, will generally address. So that's kind of getting...
And you put this issue before the court that they're compelling you, and you have to properly assert that Fifth Amendment right, and it has to be within the confines of reasonableness. It can't be, as Mr. Porter said, on anything that you can think of that you don't want to take a polygraph, but you have to carefully assert that right and set yourself up for a good case rather than a junk case.
Right.
Right, and you really got to make sure that the questions are incriminating and that somebody is kind of standing in the background threatening you. And, you know, whenever you're going to be taking something into court, you want to document, right? So, you want to have witnesses who are going to say yes. If he didn't answer that question, we were going to revoke his probation. And here were the exact questions. So, a lawyer can establish, listen, this could lead to a criminal prosecution for a new offense. and we've got compulsion here, and we've got a pattern of repetition. So we want the court to address it. So that's kind of the court side too, William. But there's another side that I think is worth taking up in all jurisdictions, is you take this decision, and there's a Supreme Court of from the state of Utah decision that's very similar in nature that cites the Von Behren case, and you take it to your entities that drive these policies, right? So your parole board or your Department of Corrections or whoever allows these policies to happen, and you say, listen, if your agencies underneath, you know, this government entity are continuing to do this, they are violating the Fifth Amendment. You need to tell them to stop. And if they don't stop, then you kind of get with other folks and consider filing for an injunction for getting your Department of Corrections or your parole division or whoever's violating the Fifth Amendment to stop violating the Fifth Amendment and come up with better questions that don't require a Fifth Amendment violation for treatment.
Right. All right, that's good. Thanks.
Okay,
thanks a lot. Next question.
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Oh, okay. I was just making sure it was my turn. This is Jimmy. Yep. I was just going to ask, for people that have already been compelled to take the test, and like in the Eighth Circuit, they don't ask us if you've had any contact with anybody under 15. They ask if you've had any contact with anybody under 18. And there's some other questions very, very similar to what you had just mentioned, but most people in this circuit have been put on lifetime supervision, and they're told that if they have any violations or anything of noncompliance or make any resistance, that they have no chance of getting off. The other thing is no one up to date has been released from lifetime supervision in the Eighth Circuit, so everybody's still trying to cling to this glimmer of hope that maybe someday that it can happen. So they want to be as compliant as they can, but as soon as you take these tests, they whack you, and they put I've seen myself and others that have been taken and put back so far in the program just because they didn't like some of the answers, and you still don't know if they're going to do anything more to you. When you've already got to that, you feel like, what can you do now? Because it's too late. You've already taken the polygraph.
So what's the question?
What can be done for the people that have already been compelled to take these?
Gotcha.
I mean, for the people that are in other circuits outside of the 10th, like here in the 8th, where they are still mandating that we have to take these, and that if we don't take these, that we are not in violation, and they do violate you, and you'll get locked back up. And nobody wants to get that, because when they take you off, even if you might eventually get out, like the other guy was saying from New York, in a month or two or a few months, nothing's changed for you. You're back, put in the same room, told this, you know, you're going to be subjected to it. So it just seems hopeless.
It seems like what you're complaining about is the polygraph, having to take the polygraph at all.
Well,
not
yeah.
that it's going to bring about some sort of a new charge. And I think that's a different issue. I don't see the polygraph going away for a while, and Mr. Porter and Mr. Neely can chip in on that. But the treatment providers feel that they cannot do any good with their treatment plans if they don't have total honesty, and so they have convinced the legislators to bring in the polygraph to make sure that people are complying. But I don't know how that. I mean, are you saying that people are being required to incriminate themselves,
yes,
and new charges are being brought?
People are being required to answer those questions, and people are being punitive actions are being taken against people, even if they pass the polygraph and have truthfully answered something. That if there's something disclosed, whether it's a sexual history polygraph, a maintenance polygraph, or not, punitive action is being taken against people, not to the point that they've been brought like a new charge, but their conditions and restrictions are intensified for probation that they're already on, and they still have the threat and the risk of the potential new charge could still come. And they won't clarify or say whether or not that it's not going to come. They, you know, they act like, well, that's not our department. You know, that's you know, I work in probation. I don't work in, you know, that's the prosecution and the police. And when you talk to the therapist, oh, well, I just provide therapy. You know, everything's compartmentalized, and they just kick everything off to the other guy so they don't have to answer any of your questions directly. So they want to keep everybody in a state of limbo and paranoia, and no one trusts the probation office or the therapist anymore, because so many of us in the Eighth Circuit have complied, taken the thing, passed it, but still been punished with our restrictions being intensified, and now we feel like we're screwed, like we have no hope of ever getting off probation anyway. So is there anything else?
Well, and Timmy, so yeah, certainly don't. I don't, you know, I don't want to be the sacrificial lamb. I don't want to be the one in there that the demands my Fifth Amendment rights be respected, and then I get locked up, right?
Right.
You know, and treatment providers and the people that supervise folks on sex offender probation, you know, they abuse their power left and right. That's a given, right? So I certainly understand and I kind of acknowledge that fear. So that's kind of why I brought up the other avenue, where it's not one person kind of having to throw themselves, you know, into the fire. Mm-hmm. Is you're going to the agency that sets up these guidelines. So maybe it's your sex offender management board locally, and you bring them this case and you say, listen, you have to stop it, or you take it to the Department of Corrections and you have to stop that, and you get an attorney who's willing to go in and file for an injunction, basically to have the civil rights violation stop. And, you know, that's going to kind of require a lot of evidence to show, you know, there's a couple of interesting things that came out of the Von Behring cases. Hey, it's real easy. If you want people to answer incriminating questions, grant them immunity. Right. If your real purpose is because you want to treat people and you want to make them better, and so that's your primary reason of why you're doing these polygraphs, well, then you're not really interested in prosecuting them, right? So you're interested in getting them treatment. So grant them immunity. Right? That solves the problem from answering these incriminating questions. But, you know, Larry and I and Barbara were talking earlier. They don't likely want to do that, although they routinely do it. States routinely do it for people who are accused of child abuse and their children are taken away, and they're supposed to participate in treatment, but they're granted immunity for their counseling sessions and whatnot, because everybody really has an interest in parents getting back their kids.
Mm-hmm.
So they could grant immunity, and then also they could also, I don't think it's credible to say, no, we have to ask these type of incriminating questions in order for therapy to be successful, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's a bunch of bull. So, you know, we'd probably need experts to come in and say, yeah, that's a bunch of bull. You don't need these questions. They're violating the Fifth Amendment. So, yes, court, who's you know, hearing this appeal from people who are having their Fifth Amendment right violated, yes, court, you should grant this relief. So I think that's kind of the only other way to go, besides having somebody who's willing to just say no and go through the appeal process and kind of deal with the consequences if they happen. Maybe you're fortunate, like in the Von Behring case, and you get that last-minute stay, so you're not locked up and you have an intelligent court really look at this issue. So, you know, it's looking at what kind of jurisdiction you're in, what kind of judges you're dealing with, to pursue either of those avenues. One is the litigation in court through an actual case, and the other one is kind of the systemic change litigation.
All right. Thanks a lot. We'll go ahead and move on to the next question. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm in Orlando, Florida. My question is, does it violate the HIPAA law when your treatment provider receives a copy of your polygraph and then sends it, even though you have passed it, sends it to your probation officer, and who knows who else is looking at it? Does it violate the HIPAA law?
We had that conversation today.
Yeah.
Normally you are required as a condition of probation to sign a waiver that permits the treatment provider to share any information he obtains with your probation officer. Now, whether or not we think that's fair or whatever, that's a different question, but generally when you're signing all those conditions of probation, that's one of the things that you're required to sign.
And that's Larry? At the probation office?
Yes.
Right. And so, you know, that, I think probably, you know, some of the callers and listeners would know that that's just kind of something that routinely is thrown on the desk that probationers have to sign, mm-hmm. is releases for all treatment providers. And I don't think that would be deemed like a compelled HIPAA violation to have to do that waiver, because most courts, or maybe all courts, are going to find that that's all in the pursuit of this supposed treatment. You know, proper for a condition of probation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Wish we could give you an answer different than that, because I've experienced that very same issue myself, is they compel you to sign the release, and if you don't sign it, then that's not cooperating with the treatment provider's requirements, and so you're in catch 22.
Definitely. Okay, our next caller.
Hi, this is Terry. Yeah, this is Terry Borden from Arizona. The question I have is, have any other of the circuits made any rulings around polygraph, or is this sort of unique to the 10th?
You know, I did a quick cite of Von Behren to see if there were any other decisions out there, and I believe there was one that had distinguished it that didn't really have an impact. And, you know, the Von Behren case doesn't really cite other jurisdictions on this issue. So I suspect that it's pretty new, idea.
It is, Barry. I did, Barbara and I both, we were furiously looking for the 11th Circuit case, and we queried Casemaker and Fast Case and everything we could think of, and we didn't unearth anything. So this is a developing area of law. And what one of you to explain what when we say this is a developing area, what that means, so that people understand what we're talking about here. Barry?
Yeah. I'm
when
sorry.
We, when
this
we talk about
develop-
something, this is a developing area of law. What are we talking about?
Well, that it's kind of a new thing that's started to be challenged. You know, because polygraphs have become so omnipresent in supervision, and people are finally starting to realize, hey, you know, I'm kind of afraid when I answer these questions that they're going to turn around and prosecute me. So it's, I think, just kind of starting to surface.
So it's through the advent of polygraphs have been around for a long time, but as far as for this particular type of use, it's relatively new. So these are questions that have not been raised in a judicial setting before. So how far we might can go in developing this area of the law, we don't know, because the issues the people have challenged so far have been about the sexual history and about unprosecuted conduct. We don't know what might develop if people assert other challenges and say that that violating conditions of probation would be also a Fifth Amendment protected. We don't know, and we have to speculate that when people say, well, what would happen, I always say, well, courts tend to be very conservative. So if I were guessing, they will provide you as little protection as possible. But we truly don't know how much further this law could, how much further we can expand von Behring in terms
well,
of how far
I,
you
yeah,
can
what, one of the things that William in the second district in New York brought up is just giving a sexual history, right? So not in, even in a polygraph setting. Is it, you know, this? So this is just your PO asking you all of these questions about your sexual history. They're incriminating, and you're forced to answer them. So you're being compelled, and they're incriminating. So even though they're not in the polygraph setting, they're violating the Fifth Amendment rights. So that's kind of a whole new area for us to look at as well. And then it's going to come down probably to a battle of, you know, the probation departments all saying, we have to have this information, otherwise our treatment won't be valid. But they, you know, hopefully have to prove that with actual real science. And the competing side of, well, then... you know, you're violating my Fifth Amendment rights. And so the solution, where some courts have gotten in some other areas, is immunity. You know, if it's really so valuable a treatment that you need it, but Fifth Amendment rights are so valuable that we're not going to allow it, and the solution is grant immunity or ask better questions that don't violate the Fifth Amendment. And so, you know, we might not have... You know, it'd be interesting to know from the listeners is how many, you know, maybe a survey, Larry, from RSOL of how many people are being asked these questions in, you know, throughout the country and with the threat of revocation.
Well, we certainly do have some reach, Barry. We can reach a significant number, but nowhere, it'll be a tip of the iceberg. But it would be interesting to see how far this cancer has gone. So there are more questions, so thank you for that one.
We definitely still have a lot of questions in the queue. So, folks, you've been doing a good job of keeping them short, but definitely keep them short. Okay, next person.
My name is Dave from Rhode Island, and we don't have that as a condition of our probation down here. But everything that I've read, that a polygraph is not admissible in court. So how can they use this against the people on probation and parole in the court to prosecute them?
Good question. I love it because they generally don't use it in court. But go ahead, Barry. You're in the state where they are admissible, so tell us a little bit about...
Well, sure, yeah. So New Mexico is the only state where polygraph actually is admissible at trial. So that's kind of interesting, but they don't need to admit the polygraph. They're just going to admit your answers. So they're not going to admit the polygraph results. They're going to admit your incriminating answers. If they were, you know, specific enough, the naming an individual, a jurisdiction, then charges could flow.
Okay. Well, let me expand on that. This is a good opportunity with 60 people on the line. I have not seen a petition for revocation that says that the person, that the petition is being filed because the person failed a polygraph, showed deception. What I have seen is that the person either refused to take the polygraph and they were revoked, or they made some admission in the course of the exam. So if there's anybody out there who can send us a petition that says the basis for the underlying move to revoke was that they failed a polygraph, we would be very, very interested in undertaking that as a cause, considering that to undertake as a cause, because I'm not aware of that. No one has shown me a petition that says they showed deception, therefore they're moving to revoke their probation.
Right, and most states, most lawyers in other states, if they got a petition like that, they say, come on, judge, we all know polygraphs are not reliable. They're not even admissible in court, except in New Mexico.
So, but they don't even do that here in terms of the use of the polygraph. The use of the polygraph, largely what it does is it gets people to confess. It gets people to make admissions and to have loose lips, because they're convinced that the polygraph is going to detect deception. So when the examiner comes in and says, you know, we got some real problems here, we're showing a +7 or a -8 on this particular answer, and I have a feeling that you're not telling me everything, the person fesses up and says, yeah, I guess I did have sex with a 13-year-old. And, yeah, I guess I was going out after curfew. Because, you know, they'll say, you're, when we ask you, have you complied with all of your terms of supervision, you show deception. And then the person says, well, I did go out after curfew a couple of times, or I did do X, Y, and Z. And that's what revokes you.
Yeah.
The admission of what you just told after the exam was concluded.
All right.
So.
All right, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll move on to the next question. Go right ahead.
Hi, this is Andy from Georgia, and my question is, I guess, a little bit vague and hard to communicate, but just by refusing to answer a question or a couple questions, doesn't that kind of imply guilt of some sort if you've already answered other questions?
Well, it could mean, you know, to the examiner, oh, you're hiding something, but you're not incriminating yourself because you're not giving specifics of an offense.
Fair. You flip that around. That's perfect. That's kind of what I mean. Instead of saying incriminating, you're definitely showing that you're hiding something. If you said, no, I didn't jaywalk, but then you say, no, I'm not going to answer that other question. Then
right.
You're
so
going to end up under the hot
there.
Water.
Right. Yeah. You know, that's possible that they could make that sort of inference, or they could just, you know, maybe make the inference that you're up on your constitutional rights and you're not going to have them violated.
Okay.
All right. I think that's a good question, frankly. I'd wondered that myself, that you've got, you know, you're refusing to answer on the grounds that I might be incriminated. That's kind of the standard line. And it does certainly make people go, uh-huh. And so, yeah. Yeah, I definitely get that. All right. But that's... You're
Brenda,
still just not telling them anything, right?
Yeah, we had a kind of a real frank discussion because Barbara and I, as lawyers, we can never advise anybody to not tell the truth or to lie, right, especially to law enforcement. But it certainly would not serve you to admit a new crime with details.
Exactly.
Maybe a little stronger, Barry. I would say that we advise anyone on this call not to confess to a crime unless they have the competent counsel of a licensed attorney in their jurisdiction.
Right, because you're right. The penalty of, you know, if you're caught supposedly not telling the truth on a polygraph is we haven't seen anybody suffer a penalty except we talked about maybe increased supervision conditions.
Yeah. Okay. We'll move on
that
to the next question.
That is a very likely outcome of showing deception. If you clam up and you maintain your posture that you can't explain why the deception is showing, they are likely to increase supervisory requirements. They may increase your frequency of reporting. They may apply GPS if you don't already have it. They may reduce your curfew. But I have not seen a revocation action undertaken for deception. But I have seen increases in supervision.
Okay. Well, we'll move on to the next question. We do have a lot, Larry, so keep moving along. Next.
Hi, this is Marie. I wanted to ask if you're allowed to take other people in with you for when you have the polygraph so that you can have someone else documenting what's going on?
Generally, no.
Yeah,
most polygraph, the polygraph exams that are done here in New Mexico, they're required to be recorded. So it may be recorded, and I think that might even be best practices for, you know, professional polygraphers.
Okay, so
you could ask for a recording.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay.
I would be surprised if they would allow someone to go in. I would be very surprised if they would allow someone on your side. Now they might happily have someone on the law enforcement side. I've heard of that, but I'd be very surprised if they'd allow the examinee to have someone of their choosing in.
I understand that it's very expensive to have an independent examiner review the results. I mean, that's something that you can do. If you disagree with the results, but it's also an expensive proposition.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next question.
Oh, no, it's already been answered.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
We appreciate that.
Yeah. Very nice. Thank you. We will go ahead and move on to the next one, though. Next caller.
Yes. We're calling from Texas.
Uh-huh.
And our son is in federal prison here. And my question is, when he's released, we're new at this, so we don't understand, what is the difference between parole, probation, or supervised release?
They're kind of all the same thing with different names. So supervised release is kind of what federal court now calls probation. They still have probation for some very, very few offenses, but primarily everybody who does a term of incarceration gets a sentence of supervised release, and that can range from two years to life.
And who determines the length of time?
The judge at sentencing. So your son will already know what his SR term is going to be.
If he's in prison, he already knows his term of supervised release.
It's in his judgment.
Okay. And if usually when someone's questioned by authorities, they have the right to have an attorney. Why is it that you can't have an attorney present during a polygraph test if you're being questioned?
I don't know. I wish we had a polygrapher on here. But the ones that I've talked to, they always just do it. I've had them do it in my office, but they don't have anybody else present because it could be a distraction and it could, you know, flaw the test results. So I think that's one reason. Whether an attorney, say, could, you know, observe it from, you know, another room through, you know, a speaker or something. I think that could be done if the polygrapher allows it or if the agency allows it, but I don't think there's any right to it.
Okay. And is polygraph always mandatory for everybody that's released, whether it's probation, supervised release, or parole?
So for sex offenders, I think it's very commonly used for sex offender treatment and monitoring.
Right. It sounds to me like, you know, this is polygraph is supposed to help with treatment, and it sounds like it's doing just the opposite.
Bingo.
Bingo.
That's exactly what it's doing.
And what can be done about this? I mean, is there anything that we can do, or RSOL, or Texas Voices?
Well, it sounds like what the folks here are recommending is, since it's what Larry was calling a developing area of law,
yes.
What can be done is resist.
Yes, we're working to develop this area of law. In fact, Mr. Porter and I were talking about disseminating this Von Behring case widely in New Mexico to make sure that all the supervising entities are aware of it. We've been a little slow on the throttle to get that done, but there has to be a coordinated reaction rather than individual reaction. It's difficult for an individual to fight this battle by themselves. So the state groups, if this is a priority for them, they're going to have to step up and take some initiative to communicate that this is a problem, particularly within the 10th Circuit. And as the case law develops around this issue, we will be able to do more and more. But it's a slow process. The answers that people are wanting are going to come slowly.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's sounding to me like is that you would, you would get together with other supervised persons, and as the guy in Missouri was saying, and come up with, okay, here's all the common questions that everybody keeps getting asked and is causing them to be revoked, and find an attorney and challenge it. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, I'm sure, but I mean, I think that's what I'm hearing from our attorneys. Am I getting that close to right?
Yeah, and challenge it in two different avenues. You know, you can challenge it through litigation and actual cases, or challenge it through the government agencies. And challenge
just
the science
the agency
of polygraphs
and
at all being involved in sex offender treatment. And try and educate the people who make those decisions and get them to change the policies.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've got quite a few more still waiting.
Yes, we do. We've got the next person on. I think.
Hi,
are you there? There you are.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes,
sir.
Go ahead.
This is Michael Shipkin from Beverly, Massachusetts, just north of Boston. I'm going to take a pass because the gentleman from Rhode Island asked my question with regard to the admissibility of polygraphs in court. So
Excellent.
Thank you very much,
yeah.
Rhode Island.
Sure. If anybody else, I think this will work. If anybody else is in the queue that's had their question answered already, I think if you press star 6 again, it may take you out of the queue. I can't guarantee that because I haven't tested it. But that way you don't have to sit there in the queue and, you know, just to tell everybody you don't have a question anymore. We'll give that a try if anybody else is in the queue that way.
Yeah,
okay.
I think it does work, Brenda.
Okay, good. Next question.
Hi, this is John in Arkansas. How's everybody doing?
Doing fine.
Hello, John.
I've got two questions. The first, after I took a plea bargain that still has me on the registry, I took a polygraph on my own with an independent person who was not connected with my case at all. I passed the polygraph. Now, I'm still trying to get myself off the list, termination of obligation to register. The first question I've got, can my polygraph results or should my polygraph results in any way, shape, or form be used to strengthen my argument for termination of obligation to register? And the second question I got from another registrant here in the state, he wanted me to ask, in his case, a minor accused him of sexual molestation, but the accuser was too scared to take a polygraph, and he wanted me to ask, would that or should that have any influence on how a case goes forward in a district court in a state?
Very seldom are victims required to take any kind of polygraph. You know, we've talked about that. We talked about that at the conference, that these people make these allegations, but they're not required to undergo any sort of testing to make sure that the allegations that they're making are true.
Well, maybe I worded it wrongly. Should the fact that the accuser, though a minor, was scared, afraid to take the polygraph, should that have any weight on the way a sex offense case goes forward?
I think the attorney could argue that. What do you think,
Claire?
Yeah, Claire?
Exactly. That's the kind of thing I would take to the district attorney as far as arguing for, you know, charges to go away. As far as whether or not that can be brought into court, you know, most courts, because this is kind of a contradiction, is because most courts find polygraphs in a lot of decisions, they're so unreliable, you can't even mention that somebody refused to take a polygraph.
Right.
Because it'd be a nice thing to cross-examine the minor on and say, isn't it true? You know, you were asked to take a lie detector test, and you refused to take the test. And, you know, the jury can, you know, gasp, and hopefully impeaches their credibility to a degree. But even here in New Mexico, where we have, you know, very liberal laws as far as cross-examination, that is foreclosed because polygraphs are deemed so unreliable. But yet, we use them after convictions, and we mandate their use, and we rely on them, and we punish people based upon polygraph results.
So, John, I'm going to ask that we punt on your other question, because neither of these attorneys know anything about the removal process in Arkansas, and it'll devour a lot of time, and it'll distract from the questions about supervised conditions and the litigation that's developing regarding this. But I'll be happy to talk to you about it off the line, but if that's okay with you, we'll punt that one for later.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, John. Okay, we'll move on. Next caller. I think you're on mute. Unmute yourself. We've lost him.
Okay, well, that clears out that one out of the queue.
That clears it on out. Okay, next question. Have I lost everyone?
Nope, not everyone.
No, but everybody that I'm calling on.
Well, where are you at on the list here?
067.
Hello?
There you are, 0645. Okay, you must have been on mute too. Go ahead.
Okay.
You may have already answered this for me, but I'm going to reiterate it again, and that is, frankly, I do not see any reason why if a person goes to take a polygraph that they cannot take legal counsel with them.
Well,
it ought to be doable, but it sounds like it's just not commonly done.
Several polygraph tests when I was in Florida, 2004, and they were, after I took the third one and passed it, I was required to take another one, and I went to my psychologist, and I said, look, I can't afford to keep taking these. I've passed three of them. Why does this continue? And he actually went to the probation officer and got a decision that I no longer had to take additional polygraphs.
We didn't say it couldn't be done. What we said was it was not practical and not done. You can do like Rosa Parks. You can refuse to get off the bus and move to the back. You can show up with your attorney, and you can say, my attorney has the right to be here, and you can assert that as a right and see what happens.
Sure. I think that would be, really help from having to go through a process after the fact,
So,
especially if you've incriminated yourself.
Not many people can afford to have an attorney spend that kind of time. The public system doesn't have attorneys to do that. They can barely cover the courtrooms they're in. But that would certainly be something that a person who had a lot of courage could try. I mean, do either attorneys see anything wrong with trying it if someone is ready to?
Certainly nothing wrong with trying it. I've asked to attend probation meetings with my clients, and those have been refused.
Okay, well, I just thought I'd interject that.
Thank you. Sure. Okay. We'll move on to the next person then. Hopefully they're unmuted already. Go right ahead.
That would be 6-4.
Hello. How are you?
Hi. What's your question?
Well, my question is this, and I've been listening, I'm trying to work with actually my state representative here in Connecticut, and I'm actually trying to find out if we can have the polygraphs actually thrown out for the treatment process, because the American Psychologists Association actually states that the U.S. versus Sheffer in 1998 states that the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly rejected the use of polygraph evidence because of its unreliability. So, I mean, is that worth pursuing? Is that something that is, worth working and spending all that time on to get polygraphs actually thrown out for treatment purposes?
I think absolutely. Where you want to go is to universities and people who have done studies and, people who know about successful treatment, and then you want experts who know about the fallibility of polygraphs, and present them to legislators and say, listen, you're wasting, and, of course, legislatures really like the idea of saving money. You're wasting, if taxpayers are paying for it, taxpayer dollars on something that's ineffectual. So if you can present that evidence and convince legislators or people on the Sex Offender Management Board of your state to do away with this, I think you can be doing a great service to your community.
Now, you also mentioned, because I've actually looked at this as we talked about polygraphs and seemingly only being used for the sex offenders and not with other criminals per se. Do we find that to be discriminatory, and is that a case that we can argue?
I would say that the arguments on the other side will probably win the day, and they're going to say they're therapeutic, and this is about protecting our children, and yada, 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 and so I don't think it goes anywhere. So I wouldn't put my energy there.
Okay.
And I would agree there, too, because the treatment providers here in Georgia say that they cannot provide treatment without some assurance that the client is being honest, and the only vehicle they have for that is the lie detector test every 6 months.
But if they're using vague questions such like, did you have a drink last night? And they kind of leave you with either a yes or no question. I mean, how does that prove whether or not an individual was telling the truth?
So we're kind of getting into...
Yeah, because we're getting off the legalities, but and we got about 9 people at least still in the queue.
Right. But just, Larry, I can just address it real quickly. So polygraph exams, the questions, they can't be ambiguous. They have to be specific, and they can't go to somebody's state of mind. So otherwise, they're just not valid. So, it would not... be a bad thing to have an expert in polygraphs take a look at questions, see if they're valid at all.
Wouldn't the question, did you have a drink, isn't that a straightforward question? You either did or you didn't.
Yeah, that one is. Well, did you have a drink when?
Right? Yeah.
And are they talking about alcohol or soda?
Yeah.
Right.
So there are ambiguities there.
So, okay. Let's try to sharpen the questions and the answers because we're getting nearer the 90-minute mark.
We are. So we've got a few people here who are I think, maybe second-timers. I'm not sure I'm going to recognize it because most of these people are just numbers. Next caller.
Hello, this is Robert. I'm unfortunately in South Alabama, and they're very strict here. I have lifetime supervision, and as part of my supervised release, I'm required to take a polygraph once a year. And I'm going to court to challenge my the supervised release soon. And one of the grounds, I broke my neck a long time ago, so I'm paralyzed. And the polygraph people say that somebody who's paralyzed should not take a polygraph. So that's one of the things that I want to challenge the supervised release on. Also, I have PTSD, and the polygraphs are given at the probation office where I was initially taken and told that I was facing life in prison and all of that. And my psychiatrist says that the whole supervised release process is re-traumatizing me. So when I
need to double check here. What you're kind of getting onto a story. Is there a question about the polygraph and the legal thing?
Well, I think probably you've already answered this because I didn't hear much about challenging. But has anybody challenged the polygraph under the conditions of, there's some reason why you shouldn't take a polygraph, like you have a neurological problem or you have PTSD?
I see.
No, but it's a viable challenge. So
we have not unearthed it, but you'd be a good candidate for it, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll let you know what happens when I finally get before the judge.
We would love to stay in touch with you. If you're not an RSO member, we would love to know how you... when you're with a federal defender, a public defender, you're going to get good representation, generally speaking. So I would be delighted to hear what they come up with.
Well, I have a lawyer that I paid $85,000 to already, so he's obligated to at least try to get me off supervised release once. So
good luck with that. All right, and do stay in touch with us, definitely. Okay, we'll move on to the next person. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, this is Ellen in Dallas. Similar question to the one that was just asked. Are there any mitigating circumstances for parolees who have diagnosed mental stability issues, such as bipolar, or even who suffer memory loss due to significant seizure disorders? Is this something a parolee should disclose to the polygrapher? And are there any mitigating circumstances that would affect the outcome of this to certain degrees?
Wow. That would be a good question for a polygrapher.
Yeah, it would, and there's a lot of things that affect the validity of polygraph. I mean, I have to tell my clients you can't have coffee in the morning. You can't, you know, you can't eat certain things. So there's certainly mental illness and diagnosis could possibly affect things.
Well, we're going to do a show with a polygrapher in the future. One of these programs we're going to have one. He just wasn't available for this particular time, but we will bring one on.
Great, thank you.
All right, thanks. And, Cindy, this is your second go-around, so be quick, please.
Yes, Brenda.
We still got a lot of people in the queue.
Okay, I just wanted to ask, while we were on the phone, I checked, and we're in the second district with New York and Vermont and Connecticut. I'm not sure if Rhode Island's in our district or not. Is there any benefit to getting together these states and sort of mounting a strategy to fight the polygraph?
Yes.
There is. So we would all approach it at the state level and then together at the circuit level, or can we bypass the state?
That's a more complicated question.
No.
But
you'd have to exhaust your state remedies before you take it into Fed court, I think.
Okay. My other question is that in the state of Connecticut, we have one treatment provider. And, you know, it's like money exchanging hands, and the one state treatment provider is the only one that they say is allowed to do a polygraph. So if I go to my own psychologist treatment provider, if I need a polygraph, I have to go back to the state provider. Do you think that's legal or violating anything?
It's probably not illegal. It doesn't sound, you know, very ethical. So
okay.
That might be something you bring up to the agencies that make those decisions.
And then my last comment, it's just a comment, it's really quick. I was at a state meeting November 23rd on assessment and management, and the polygraphs came up, and the victim's advocate said straight out, they need the polygraph to find more victims. And it was like, I mean, just shocking. To hear, I think they were younger victims advocates, but to hear them say that and sort of to slap down the entire judiciary process, that's not the way our legal system works. And it sort of goes back to, like, the public registry. Is it civil or is it punitive? Are, like, what are polygraphs for, treatment or to punish offenders more? Well, I'll go with the latter. So, anyway, that's all. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Cindy. Okay, bye-bye. And next question.
Hello. I'm Chris, also from Connecticut, and I'm also working with, or trying to work with state legislatures on this same issue, and I can probably help out on all the money that's being wasted, because I've done a ton of research on the polygraph. But my question is, I found a legal, I guess, deconstruction of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeal. It was an article, and one of the things that it brought up was that under U.S. Code 18, Sections 241 through 245, is that once you take the polygraph, according to the lawyers that wrote this briefing, that once you take it, whether you pass, fail, or inconclusive, that under the U.S. Code, is that now you can now sue both the probation office and the treatment provider and also press criminal charges. And I was wondering your thoughts on that.
Boy,
press
that's outside of
what?
My scope of knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was just a brief analysis, I guess you could say, of that ruling.
You said 18 U.S.C. what?
It was Title 18, Sections 241 through 245.
Okay. Well, I'll certainly take a look at that.
I've read those sections, and it sounds quite interesting.
If only we knew what it meant, right?
So yeah. We're going to need to move on. We've got a lot of people in the queue, and we're going to take two more questions. So
okay. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Maggie from Minnesota. I was curious if coming to probation through juvenile court changes anything regarding strategy.
Well, you might want to look at the validity of polygraph results on minors, and
okay.
whether you know that could have an impact. And I kind of would argue, you know, a minor does not have the wherewithal to figure out, you know, instantaneously. Gee, is this an incriminating question?
And right.
So it's really something that should not be used in cases of minors.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Last question.
Yeah, this is Roger from Colorado. A couple of questions. One is the sex history packet that folks have to fill out. It seems that would be as incriminating from a Fifth Amendment standpoint as a polygraph examination. And also the importance of the pre-test and post-test questions that don't have anything to do with the actual polygraph.
I love that because I've seen your questionnaire. They adapted it to New Mexico, and it's a horrendous sexual history questionnaire that Colorado uses. And so it is. If you answer that thing truthfully, you would set yourself up for endless prosecutions. Most people would. It asks you everything that you can conceive of.
Well, in that Bennett case, Larry, that you provided from the Supreme Court of Utah, that had a really detailed sexual history where the person had to name alleged victims and give dates and, you know, months and dates and where things happened. So I think case, right, the Supreme Court of Utah case, it's what the Bennett v. Bigelow case, found that those violate Fifth Amendment, right?
And the pretest and the post-test questions are also potentially incriminating. But the pretest is where you figure out what they're going to ask you. So you have to do a pretest interview. They can't just hook you up. So I'm not sure what your point was on the pretest questions.
Well, just that, you know, anything you say they use when they, you know, write out their report.
Yes, they do. They do that.
And could it be incriminating even in the pretest? Yes.
Yes. They're gonna try to frame up the questions in the pretest interview, so you very well could incriminate yourself in the pretest interview. You could incriminate yourself more likely in the post-test interview, and you can incriminate yourself during the questions if you answer yes.
Yeah, so pull that Supreme Court Utah decision. It probably has some, you know, some good thought, and it cites Von Behren extensively, and that deals with the sexual history questionnaire.
So
very good. All right.
We are at 95 minutes since we began this call, and I don't think we can impose any more on our guests. On our panel. So, Ms. Gale, I know your life is very, very busy with all the responsibilities you have with the various things you're involved in. So thank you for coming and
pleasure,
spending
always.
Time with us. And Mr. Porter, I know that you actually do trials and you're a very busy attorney. And it's my pleasure to work with you on cases from time to time, and I'm glad you could give your time to us this evening to help.
Absolutely. Anything to help RSOL. You guys are doing really powerful work.
So, I thank the people who are still here, which we haven't lost that many, for showing up tonight on a few days before Christmas. RSOL is doing what we can with what we have, which is never enough. And we would like everyone who's not a member to consider becoming one. And I'm going to say that we appreciate every one of you that support us. And on behalf of the board, thank you. And Brenda, I'm sure you have something you want to say about your next call and any words of wisdom.
Well, we don't actually have a call this month. That this was kind of a joint one. But we do have some good things coming up for advancing advocacy in the coming months ahead, just as Larry has managed to find some wonderful things. So, yes, also I just want to thank everybody for being on the call and wish you wonderful holidays, and that do consider RSOL and your giving over the coming weeks and months, as we can't continue doing this stuff without your help. So that's one way to be able to help us out. But again, happy holidays. Thanks for being here, and have a good rest of the week.
So I guess we can terminate the recording and